This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Why is it so hard for most of us to ever change our minds? On matters small.
By age 35, if you're not eating sushi, 95% chance you never will.
And large.
So this was like almost a year after the war had started or the invasion had happened. And that's the moment that I, you know, decided these people are really nuts.
This week on Freakonomics Radio, how to change minds, or at least try to.
Well, there's no silver bullet.
Why not just try using some compelling facts?
This model where people just take facts and draw conclusions is completely wrong.
The incentives are also tricky.
If they were to change their tune, everybody would see them as a loser.
It's coming up right after this hour's news. Here's an interesting fact. Legislators in several Republican-controlled states are pushing to eliminate the death penalty. Why is that interesting? Because most Republicans have typically been in favor of the death penalty. They've said it's a deterrent against the most horrific crimes and a fitting penalty when such crimes do occur. But a lot of Republicans have come to believe the death penalty does not deter crime, which happens to be an argument we offered evidence for in Freakonomics. They also say the lengthy legal appeals on death penalty cases are too costly for taxpayers. Some Republicans also cite moral concerns with the death penalty. And so, a lot of them have changed their minds. We've all changed our minds at some point about something. Maybe you were a cat person, and you became a dog person. Maybe you decided the place you lived, or the person you loved, or the religion you followed, that they weren't working for you anymore. But changing your mind is rarely easy, and it's not something you set out to do. Although, if you're like most people, you would very much like other people to change their minds, to think more like you. Because as you see it, it's impossible for the world to progress, to improve, unless some people are willing to change their minds. But like I said, it won't be easy, because changing your mind means admitting, on some level, that you used to be wrong. It can be seen as an act of weakness, even heresy. Tell me something that you believed to be true for a long time until you found out you were wrong.
The list is endless. I used to be a very serious pianist, and I was one of the snot-nosed classical ones who was appalled by, like, nightmares of Ethel Merman and trombones blasting in the background and who knows what else. And then the wonderful person I married turned out to be a musical theater fanatic. And in fact, my wife is a musical theater director.
So it wasn't just a case of you accommodating out of love and familial attachment. Your actual preferences changed?
Oh, I thrill at the excitement of, like, seeing a bunch of barely remembering their lines high school students stumbling their way through Music Man. Or actually, that's not true. I still loathe Music Man. But I actually have come to, like musicals a whole lot. She and I have done 19 of them now together. She's directed. I've been sort of the rehearsal pianist.
Oh, boy. You really went, you crossed the border then fully.
Yes. Yes.
Who is this guy? And why should we care that he's changed his mind?
I'm Robert Sapolsky. I'm a professor of neuroscience at Stanford University. And I'm kind of half neurobiologist, half primatologist. For about 30 years, I've divided my time between your basic rat lab neurons growing in petri dishes and then studying populations of wild baboons in the Serengeti in East Africa.
So considering that I'm not a neuroscientist, in fact, pretty much as far from it as could be, I do have a sense that the brain and the mind may be two separate things, but I'd love you to comment on the relationship between the two.
I am completely of the school that mind is entirely the manifestation of brain. So when there's a change in mind, there's got to be a neurobiological underpinning.
Sapolsky, as he noted earlier, has changed his own mind quite a lot. He started early.
I was raised as an Orthodox Jew in a major neighborhood specializing in that in Brooklyn. And somewhere when I was about 14, something changed. And that change probably like involved updating every molecule in my body. And that I sort of realized, this is nonsense. There's no God. There's no free will. There's no purpose. And I have not been capable of a shred of religiosity or spirituality ever since.
One thing Sapolsky noticed about mind changing is that it's easier when you're younger.
Just noticing the general phenomenon that we get less open to novelty as we get older.
So he worked up a survey to look at people's preferences in food, music, and so on.
What you wind up seeing is basically if you're not listening to a certain style of music by the time you're 28 or so, 95% chance you're never going to. By age 35, if you're not eating sushi, 95% chance you never will. In other words, these windows of openness to novelty close. But then as a biologist, the thing that floored me is you take a lab rat and you look at when in its life it's willing to try a novel type of food, and it's the exact same curve. The equivalent of 10-year-old lab rats hate broccoli as much as 10-year-old humans do. And late adolescence, early adulthood, there's this sudden craving for novelty. And that's when primates pick up and leave their home troops and transfer into new ones. And then by the time you're like a middle-aged adult rat, you're never going to try anything new for the rest of your life. It's the exact same curve, which fascinated me.
There are a lot of reasons why it may be easier to change your mind when you're younger. It could be the fact that your brain is simply more plastic then, something scientists assumed for a long time, but now we're starting to question. Or it could be that your positions are less entrenched, so it's less costly to change them. Or it could be that the stakes are lower. The fate of the world does not hinge on whether you are pro-broccoli or anti-broccoli. But as life goes on,
now, there's nothing wrong with a little indecision.
As the stakes rise,
as long as your job doesn't involve any responsibility,
changing your mind can get more costly.
John Kerry has changed his mind on all these important issues.
When Massachusetts Senator John Kerry ran for president against the incumbent George W. Bush in 2004, Kerry's campaign began to crater after it was shown that he'd changed his position, or at least his votes in the Senate, on a number of issues.
If you thought you could trust him, you might want to change your mind, too.
So I think, you know, that's the way that politics itself works.
That's Francis Fukuyama. He's a political scientist at Stanford.
My work really centers on research and practice about political institutions.
In 1992, Fukuyama wrote a book that became a sensation. It was called The End of History and the Last Man.
In the late 1980s, as I was following events in the Soviet Union, I said, well, to the extent that there's an end of history, it's going to look like liberal democracy tied to a market economy.
In other words, democracy had essentially won, not just the Cold War, but the future. And yet, a lot of the recent political momentum is going in the other direction, toward populism and authoritarianism, with a backlash against globalism. So to what degree do you think your argument was wrong, or at least premature? How confident are you that what we're seeing now is just a backlash and not actually a reversal or an entirely new strain?
I'm still reasonably confident. The way I've formulated my hypothesis right from the beginning was that you needed to show not just that there was unhappiness with liberal democracy, but you needed to posit some other form of social organization that was superior or that was somehow going to displace liberal democracy in the way that communism, you know, asserted that it would displace liberal democracy ultimately. And if you look around the world right now, there are competing systems that are not liberal or democratic. So the Chinese have one, Saudi Arabia and Iran have their versions of it. But I actually don't think that any of those alternative models are likely to become, you know, universal in the way that liberal democracy has become, in a fairly impressive way, the default form of government for very many countries around the world.
So Fukuyama has not changed his mind about his most famous assertion, although he is open to it.
If in 30 years China is bigger than the United States, richer, continues to be stable, continues to be growing faster, then I'd have to say, well, you know, maybe that is the alternative model.
But he did change his mind on something else. It goes back to that Bush-Kerry era and the Iraq War.
In which direction would John Kerry lead? Kerry voted for the Iraq War, opposed it, supported it, and now opposes it again.
At the time, Fukuyama was well-established as a prominent political thinker. In addition to writing a landmark book, he'd done two stints in the State Department. So his views on the Iraq War were taken seriously.
I signed on to a letter, you know, a couple of years before the war, saying that the United States ought to take military action.
He wasn't opposed to the U.S. desire to intervene and topple a dictator, in this case, Saddam Hussein.
I think that that's happened in the past and it's had good effects.
But as the invasion drew near, Fukuyama did have a concern.
My main concern was whether the United States was ready to actually stay in Iraq and convert it into, you know, a kind of stable, decent country. And the United States has not had a really great record in doing this in Central America and Vietnam and so forth. And in the months prior to the war, I began to get increasingly worried that we weren't prepared to actually stick it out. But even I was astonished at how bad the planning had been and how faulty the assumptions were that we were going to be greeted as liberators and that there would be a rapid transition, just like in Eastern Europe, to something that looked like democracy. In retrospect, I wish I had taken a much clearer stand against it before the war actually happened.
The U.S. invaded Iraq in March of 2003.
I was at a dinner at the American Enterprise Institute in February of 2004.
The AEI is a conservative think tank in D.C.
Dick Cheney was the featured speaker, and everybody in the room was cheering like this was the biggest success for American foreign policy that, you know, they could imagine. And I just looked around at the people at my table and I said, you know, why are these people clapping? Because clearly this thing is turning into a huge fiasco. And that's the moment that I decided, you know, these people are really nuts. I mean, they're so invested in seeing this as a success that they can't see this reality that's just growing right in front of their eyes. And to this day, I mean, it does seem strange to me that a lot of the people that, you know, were strong supporters of the war, even today, are not willing to admit that that was a mistake.
So I understand that even though you were seen as having defected from or abandoned the neoconservative movement, primarily over the Iraq War, that you were not met so warmly by the left where you moved to. You said in 2006, I've gotten many emails that said, in effect, well, you're trying to apologize, but you've got blood on your hands. We don't accept your apology.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you're seeing a similar process with a lot of other neocons right now. The neocons as a group have been the core of the Never Trump conservative movement, all of whom had been big supporters of the Iraq War and of George W. Bush, have really turned against Trump in a big way. And there are a lot of people that are not willing to accept them. They say, you know, it's too late. Exactly those words. You've got blood on your hands. And, you know, I think that that is a unduly rigid position, because in that case, no one should ever change their mind. They should never be hit on the head with reality and then realize that, you know, they've got a different position that they should take.
When we talk about changing your mind, we need to acknowledge that every situation is, of course, different. Let's say someone in your family holds a position that you find odious. Why do you find it odious? Maybe you think they're ignoring the facts. But can't people hold different positions based on the same facts? Maybe you feel their position lacks moral reasoning. But who said morality is one size fits all? Or maybe, just maybe, they hold the opposite position simply because it is the opposite.
Suppose a person has some idea about something which doesn't correspond to reality. It may be that they derive pleasure from having this idea in itself.
That's Julia Schwetz. She's an economist at Christ's College, Cambridge.
I study people's decisions empirically in order to understand better what drives people.
And in the case of someone deriving pleasure from an idea that you disagree with,
in that case, you have to ask yourself whether it's actually to their benefit for them to be changing their mind.
This idea that we can be so invested in our beliefs, even if we suspect they are wrong, Schwetz has found evidence of this in her research.
The incorrect vision of the world may actually deliver some benefit to them.
And she's found this effect not just in models or lab studies, but out in the real world, where people are constantly making decisions about their work, their families, their lives.
It seems to be a very important question whether the beliefs we hold about the outside world are somehow connected to this beliefs about ourselves. When there is a link between these beliefs, it's not so clear that we should be changing our minds. And what are the costs and benefits of this?
Consider, for instance, an expert who's dedicated their career to a certain policy or line of thinking. What happens in the face of new information? Do you seriously reconsider your long-held position and go against the tide you've been swimming in?
A lot of times you just, you know, you just feel uncomfortable if you say things that disrupt a consensus and you just don't want to do it.
Francis Fukuyama is recalling his change of mind on the Iraq War.
A lot of my friends were very, very heavily in, on the other side, and I lost a lot of them. You know, I haven't spoken to several of these friends since then.
There are two separate questions, whether the person should change their mind and what the effects are for him, and then what the effects are for other people.
There's another factor that Julia Schwetz sees as contributing to our reluctance to change our mind. Confidence. Or, more accurately, overconfidence, our own belief that we are right even in the absence of evidence. Just how much unearned confidence is floating around out there? Consider a recent study by Schwetz and some colleagues that surveyed over 200 managers at a British restaurant chain. They averaged more than 2 years on the job, and their compensation was strongly tied to a performance bonus. I mentioned the bonus because it's related to the survey that Schwetz administered. The managers were asked to recall their past performance and to predict their future performance. Presumably, they should have had a pretty good grasp of their standing.
What we found is that only about 35% of managers were accurate about the quintile of the performance distribution they were falling into.
In other words, barely a third of them were able to correctly say whether they fell in the top 20% of all managers, or the bottom 20%, or another 20% block somewhere in the middle.
And 47% of managers were overconfident about it.
And these were people who had detailed feedback about their performance every quarter, which is a lot more than most employees get.
So the next question we asked is, how is it possible that people remain so overconfident when they have so much information?
This is where memory comes into play. Or maybe you'd call it optimism or delusion.
People who did worse in the previous competition tended to remember slightly better outcomes. People seem to be exaggerating their own past performance in their head when this performance is bad. So what we conclude from this is that people use memory selectively. They remember good outcomes and they tend to forget bad ones.
So maybe it's not so much that people refuse to change their minds or refuse to update their priors, as economists like to say. Maybe they just have self-enhancing selective memories.
The data we observe are consistent with them making a choice to suppress some past information.
But there's also the possibility that people who've been at something for a while, who may consider themselves expert, that they simply don't believe that non-experts have information that's worth paying attention to.
So I was in the State Department in the policy planning staff in 1989.
Francis Fukuyama again.
And in May of 1989, after there had been this turmoil in Hungary and Poland, I drafted a memo to my boss, Dennis Ross, who was the director of the office, that sent it on to Jim Baker, who was the Secretary of State, saying we ought to start thinking about German unification, because it didn't make sense to me that you could have all this turmoil right around East Germany and East Germany not being affected. The German experts in the State Department went ballistic at this. You know, they said this is never going to happen. And this was said at the end of October. The Berlin Wall fell on November 11th. And so I think that the people that were the closest to this situation, you know, so I was not a German expert at all, but it just seemed to me logical, you know. But I think it's true that if you are an expert, you really do have a big investment in seeing the world in a certain way. Whereas if you're an amateur like me, you can kind of say whatever you think.
As you can see, there are a lot of reasons why a given person might be reluctant to change their mind about a given thing. Ego, selective memory, overconfidence, the cost of losing family or friends. But let's say that you remain committed to changing minds, your own or someone else's. How do you get that done? The secret may lie not in a grand theoretical framework, but in small mundane objects.
Toilets and zippers and ballpoint pens.
We'll get into that right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by ExtraHop, a cyber analytics company that provides threat intelligence, ML, and investigation automation. More information at extrahop.com.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by the SciSims Foundation, since 1985 supporting progress in education, science, and the arts. Information at scisimsfoundation.org.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Think of something you have a really strong opinion about. Maybe the best ways to address climate change, the perils of income inequality, how to balance privacy and security. Now think about why you have such a strong opinion. How well do you think you could explain your position?
If you're forced to give an explanation, you have to really understand, and you have to confront the fact that you might not understand. Whereas when you give reasons, then you do what people do around the Thanksgiving dinner table. They talk about their feelings about it, what they like, what they don't like.
That's Stephen Sloman.
I'm a professor of cognitive, linguistic, and psychological sciences at Brown University.
And that means, in a nutshell, that you'd try to understand what?
I try to understand how people think.
Easy question first. How do you get someone to change their mind?
Well, first of all, there's no silver bullet. It's really hard. But if you're going to try, the first thing you should do is try to get them to change their own mind. And you do that by simply asking them to assume your perspective and explain why you might be right. If you can get people to step outside themselves and think about the issue, not even necessarily from your perspective, but from an objective perspective, from one that is detached from their own interests, people learn a lot. So given how hard it is for people to assume other people's perspectives, you can see why I started my answer by saying it's very hard.
One experiment Sloman has done is asking people to explain, not reason, as he pointed out, but to actually explain at the nuts and bolts level how something works.
People don't really like to engage in the kind of mechanistic analysis required for a causal explanation.
That's true not only for big thorny issues like climate change or income inequality, but even for things like
toilets and zippers and ballpoint pens.
Unless you are a plumber or you make zippers or ballpoint pens, you probably can't explain these very well, even though before you were asked the question, you would have thought you could. This gap between what you know and what you think you know is called, naturally, the illusion of explanatory depth.
So the illusion of explanatory depth was first demonstrated by a couple of psychologists named Rosenblatt and Kyle, and they asked people how well they understood how these things worked, and people gave a number between 1 and 7. And then they said, okay, how does it work? Explain in as much detail as you can how it works. And people struggled and struggled and realized they couldn't. And so when they were again asked how well they understood, their judgments tended to be lower. In other words, people themselves admitted that they had been living in this illusion that they understood how these things worked, when in fact they don't.
Where does this illusion come from?
We think the source of the illusion is that people fail to distinguish what they know from what others know. We're constantly depending on other people. And the actual processing that goes on is distributed among people in our community.
In other words, someone knows how a toilet works, the plumber. And you know the plumber. Or even if you don't know the plumber, you know how to find a plumber.
It's as if the sense of understanding is contagious, right? When other people understand, you feel like you understand.
You can see how the illusion of explanatory depth could be helpful in some scenarios. You don't need to know everything for yourself. As long as you know someone who knows someone who knows something. But you could also imagine scenarios in which the illusion could be problematic.
So we've shown that that's also true in the political domain.
Sloman and his collaborator Philip Fernbach basically repeated the Rosenblatt and Kyle experiment. But instead of toilets and zippers, they asked people about climate change and gun control.
We gave people political policies. We said, how well do you understand them? And please explain them.
Unsurprisingly, most people were not able to explain climate change policies in much detail. But here's what's interesting. The level of confidence in their understanding of issues, which participants were asked to report at the start of the experiment, was drastically reduced after they tried and failed to demonstrate their understanding.
In other words, asking people to explain depolarized the group.
Now, was this a case of simply slowing down and thinking the issue through? Could it be that we're often inflexible in our thinking simply because we come to conclusions too quickly? Apparently not.
If instead of saying, explain how the policy works, if what we said to them was, give us all the reasons you have for your view on this policy, then we didn't get that effect at all. Right? That didn't reduce people's sense of understanding. It didn't reduce their hubris.
The ability to change your mind, would you say that's really important as a human?
I see the mind as something that's shared with other people. I think the mind is actually something that exists within a community and not within a skull. And so when you're changing your mind, you know, you're doing one of two things. You're either dissociating yourself from your community, and that's really hard and not necessarily good for you, or you have to change the mind of the entire community. And is that important? Well, the closer we are to truth, the more likely we are to succeed as individuals, as a species. But it's hard. I don't think the solution is give people the information they need.
More information can be good if it's very well filtered and curated, but that's not easy to do in an unbiased way.
That's Matthew Jackson, an economist at Stanford. Yes, I realize this episode is leaning heavily on Stanford professors. Anyway, Matthew Jackson studies social and economic networks.
So in particular, how the structure of social interactions affects people's behaviors. Anything from how our opinions form to whether we decide to vote for a certain candidate.
Here's something Jackson has changed his mind about.
One thing I used to think was that people, if you gave them the same kinds of information, they would make decisions the same way. They might have different experiences in their past, different influences, but somehow the fundamental ways in which they'd think about things and process things is the same.
That, however, is not what the data say.
The more you look at data, and in particular, the more you look at experiments where people are faced with facts or information, you realize that some people are very single-minded.
In one experiment, Jackson also asked people about climate change. He had everyone read the same batch of abstracts from scientific articles.
We asked people their opinions before, you know, they went into the study, and you know, you could see that people looking at exactly the same article would interpret it very differently depending on what their initial position was.
So again, information isn't necessarily the solution. In fact, information can be weaponized.
There was a group of about a quarter to a third of the subjects who actually became more polarized, who interpreted the information heavily in the direction of their priors and actually ended up with more extreme positions after the experiment than before.
We've talked about this phenomenon before on the show, that well-educated people who consume a lot of information tend to hold disproportionately extreme views, apparently because they're really good at seeking out information that confirms their priors and ignoring information that might run counter.
One aspect of people seeing exactly the same information and coming away with different conclusions is how we interpret and store information in our brains. It's very easy to sort of snippet things into small little pieces that we can remember. Oh, this was for or against.
We don't like breaking things down in detail. We just kind of, most of us like to have a superficial understanding.
Stephen Sloman again.
Why do you think Obamacare is good or bad, whatever you think about it? Now, the fact is most people have very little to say about that, right? Most people just have a couple of slogans, right? They have the Republican slogan, they have the Democratic slogan, but they don't actually know about Obamacare because, after all, it's a 20,000-page document. I like to say even Obama doesn't understand Obamacare.
But even if Obama does understand Obamacare, there's a question of whether his understanding is unduly circumscribed by the people around him.
People tend to associate with other people who are very similar to themselves. So we end up talking to people most of the time who have very similar past experiences and similar views of the world. And we tend to underestimate that. People don't realize how isolated their world is. You know, people wake up after an election and are quite surprised that anybody could have elected a candidate that has a different view than them.
So one antidote to inflexible thinking is simply balance.
In worlds where our network is well-balanced and we're actually eventually incorporating everybody's viewpoint, this system works extremely well.
Unfortunately, a great many of us are quite bad at creating diverse, well-balanced networks. And there's a reason for this, a reason we struggle to listen to opposing voices and, therefore, have a hard time changing our minds.
We are basically hardwired to divide the world into us and thems and to not like the thems a whole lot.
That, again, is the half-neurobiologist, half-primatologist Robert Sapolsky, who's changed his own mind many times.
The domain that I'm most interested in these days is that change thing of turning thems into us's, and how do we do that? And what the studies tend to show is take somebody else's perspective, try to go through what somebody else's rationalizations are, individuate somebody, break them out of being an automatic them, and think about, do they like the same pets that you do? Do they love their kids? Look at a picture of them singing lullabies to their children. Look at a picture of them enjoying the same like food that you do. Contact. And this has been floating around for decades as a theory. Give people of thems enough contact with each other and they turn into us's. And it turns out contact works under very specialized circumstances. You got to spend a bunch of time with thems. And us's and thems need to be in equal numbers and in a neutral setting, and you got to have a shared sort of goal. I mean, all of these work to at least some degree. The peoples we hated in the past are allies now. There are out-groups that spent centuries being persecuted where we don't even know what the word refers to anymore. And in all those cases, there's something resembling biological pathways that help them stop being so objectionable.
So before this conversation, if you had asked me, what are the primary barriers that keep someone in a given situation from changing their mind, I would have certainly opted for the social and economic explanations. But it sounds as though you're saying a larger share would go to the physiological and biological reasons. Is that right?
Well, the really irritating thing I would say is that the two are one and the same. We are nothing more or less than the sum of our biology. Every time you learn something, from something profound to something idiotic, something changes in your brain. Every time you have a sensory experience, your brain is constantly rewiring in major ways.
This idea that the brain continues to change physiologically throughout our lives, this is yet another idea that Sapolsky himself had to change his mind about.
Yep, this is a aspect of my field where I have missed the boat every step of the way. When I started off, this dogma had been in place for like 1,000 years worth of intro to neuroscience classes, which is the adult brain doesn't make new neurons. This is the basic premise of all the miserable, untreatable neurological diseases out there. And starting in the 60s, there was one lone prophet named Joe Altman, whose career was basically ruined because he was about 30 years ahead of the curve. And then late 80s, early 90s, some technique got a lot more sensitive and was able to show adult neurogenesis in the brain like crazy. And it became the hottest subject in the field. And I kept saying, that's not a real phenomenon. So I was like, really blew it on that one. It turns out that there's a little pocket, a little population of stem cells sitting in the hippocampus making new neurons. And what was even better was it made them at all the logical times in response to learning, stimulation, exercise. And a ton of work showed that these new neurons actually are useful and they're critical for new types of learning. So that ushered in this whole new world. And then this beautiful new edifice of revisionism came potentially crashing down about a year ago. An extremely, I think, important and well-done paper that wound up in the journal Nature showed that despite the clear presence of tons of neurogenesis in rodent brains throughout the lifetime, in monkey brains, there was a lot of reason to think that not a lot of the same occurred in the human brain, and that a lot of the prior evidence for it was pretty circumstantial. And as you might expect, the specialists in the field have been stabbing each other over this one ever since, and it's not clear what the resolution is.
It doesn't get much more meta than that. A bunch of scientists changing their minds and trying to change others' minds about whether the brain changes when we change our minds. Coming up after the break, from changing your mind to understanding what someone else is thinking about.
So this is one of the most liberating experiments in all of psychology, I believe.
It's coming up right after this.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire. And by TransferWise, which was built to make it easier to send money internationally. 4 million people and businesses use TransferWise to send, receive, and convert currencies in more than 70 countries. More at TransferWise.com.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
I'd like you to meet Nicholas Epley,
professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago.
That's not as arcane as it sounds.
I'm in the Booth School of Business.
Now, one of the things that we all love about academia is how incredibly down-to-earth it is and how rooted it is in empiricism. So what exactly is Epley's specialty?
I study mind reading.
So why is a business school professor studying mind reading? As Nicholas Epley explains, it's because being in business means constantly dealing with other people. And it's really helpful to understand what you can know and what you can't know about how other people think, whether they're a rival, a partner, whatever. Epley has written a book called Mindwise: How We Understand What Others Think, Believe, Feel, and Want.
Okay, so I'm an experimental psychologist, and what that means is that we put people in experiments to watch how they behave under certain conditions. And so what we do in our research is we put people in experiments that put their mind reading capacities to the test. So for instance, we might bring in married couples and ask them to predict what their spouse's attitudes are along a series of 20 different questions, say. We ask one person to predict how the other person will respond to these, and then we look at how the other person actually responds, and we compare the two. We look to see if they're correlated with each other, and if so, how much so. We also then randomly assign people to different conditions in our experiments, and so we can see how they operate under different kinds of circumstances. That allows us to make inferences about how people actually reason about the minds of others. What is it that allows us to make these sorts of inferences? What tools or heuristics or shortcut rules do we use to understand what somebody else thinks or believes or feels or wants? It allows us to understand where people might fall short, where we might make mistakes, and it also allows us to test hypotheses about how to make people do better.
So you argue in the book, and I'll quote you to yourself, "Your brain's greatest skill is its ability to think about the minds of others in order to understand them better." So when I read that, I thought, wow, that's incredibly, gosh, everything, profound, inspiring, important, all that stuff. And then I thought, really? That's our brain's greatest skill, is to think about the minds of others in order to understand them better? What makes you say that?
Well, if you look at what makes human beings unique from our closest primate relatives, for instance, we have big brains, we're really smart, but where we're really smart is in our social senses, in our social smarts. So there was an enormous experiment conducted a handful of years ago by some researchers at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. And what they did was they compared 105 human toddlers against 106 adult chimpanzees and their ability to solve certain kinds of problems. One group of these problems were physical kinds of problems, like your ability to use a tool, for instance, to achieve a goal, or your ability to track where a reward was placed under some cups. And our toddlers were doing just about as well as the chimpanzees. That is, they were neck and neck in reasoning about physical objects. But then there was another class of questions. These were questions that really required some mind reading, required some social sense. So these were the social tests where, for instance, you had to track the gaze of another person to know what they wanted, to know what their goal was, or your ability to understand somebody else's intention just by watching their behavior. And on these social tasks, on these social kinds of questions, our two-year-old toddlers were crushing the competition. Our kids were solving far more of these questions correctly than our adult primate relatives were. And that's, I think, just one piece of evidence that suggests that this is what our brains were really meant to do. We are one of the most social species on the planet. We live in some of the biggest social networks of any organism on the planet. And what separates us from others, what allows us to cooperate and to compete and to build things collaboratively, is our ability to connect with the minds of others, to know what their intentions are, what their motives are, to anticipate what they're going to do next, to know who knows what. For instance, you didn't call me out of the blue, right? Just to talk to somebody randomly for your show. You knew that I knew something that might be of interest.
Well, we got the envelope of cash that you sent, so you that's the way it works. Yeah. Right.
Spoken like an economist.
Tell us the story of the Barry Manilow T-shirt.
So this is one of the most liberating experiments in all of psychology, I believe. This was an experiment conducted by my dissertation advisor, Tom Gilovich at Cornell University, and two of his graduate students, Vicky Medvec and Ken Savitsky. And what they did was they had people come to the laboratory, and If you are the participant, just imagine that you're the participant in this experiment. You arrive in a lab room down the hall a little bit. The experimenter greets you, says thank you for coming. As part of this experiment, we just need you to put on this t-shirt. Now, you're a compliant subject. You don't ask any questions. You just do what you're told. And so you take this t-shirt and you put it on. And as you're slipping it over your head and pulling it down over your chest, you see right there in front of you, emblazoned right on your chest, is a great big picture of Barry Manilow. Her name was Lola.
She was a showgirl. Fantastic.
Yeah, you may be a fan.
I'm a fan, though.
You are. Well, so maybe this would be a pride-inducing kind of moment. But
now, I just want to get it straight. So am I putting the shirt on? Am I putting the Barry Manilow shirt on over what I'm wearing, or am I wearing it like a regular shirt?
I believe you are putting over what you are wearing, because we tend not to have people get naked in our experiments. That's a different kind of research.
The reason I'm asking you is because it's even more irregular looking.
Oh, yeah.
Because not only am I now wearing a Barry Manilow shirt, but I'm wearing a Barry Manilow shirt over my clothes.
Yeah, you don't look good. That's very clear. And it's also a big shirt because it's got to fit everybody. So you're not looking good. So you've got this big picture of Barry Manilow on your chest. And
I have to say, your anti-Manilow bias is really showing
here. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying.
So yeah, that could be right. I should tell you that the participants in these experiments were undergraduates for whom Barry Manilow was not a particularly pride-inducing figure. Mm-hmm. That said, they also ran the experiment later using figures that people were, in fact, consistently happier to have on their chest, like Martin Luther King or Jerry Seinfeld or Bob Marley. You get the same effects with them, too.
Those are my choices, Manilow, Marley, King, and Seinfeld.
In different experiments, they use different things. Also, in some experiments, use John Tesh and Vanilla Ice. So it's not just a Barry Manilow phenomenon.
Okay.
But you'll get the idea. So they put on this t-shirt, and they walk down the hallway, and you're brought into a lab room, and there happen to be a few other people sitting around the room. These are other participants in the experiment. They're already filling out their questionnaires, and the experimenter says, you've arrived a little bit late, but it's okay. Just go ahead and get started here. You then sit down and you start filling out the questionnaire. After just a moment, the experimenter turns back around and says, you know what? I'm afraid you've started a little bit late. Why don't you just come on out of the room and, you know, we'll get you started doing something else. Okay? At that point, the experiment is really over. What happens now is the experimenter asks you, how many people in that room would be able to identify that it was Barry Manilow on your shirt?
And when you say identify that it was him, not meaning like, you don't mean how many people knew that that likeness was him. You're talking about, did they notice whether I was wearing a Barry Manilow shirt or not?
That's right. Did they notice that you were wearing a Barry Manilow shirt or not? And so you predicted how many in the room you thought would be able to identify.
I would say, hey, I'm wearing a Barry Manilow shirt. 100% of the people are going to notice I'm wearing a Barry Manilow shirt.
That's right. You're... So they did something like that, yes. Whether you were proud of it or embarrassed of it, they tended to think that lots of people would notice. In fact, they thought about 50% of people in the room would notice. Because you weren't in there for a long time, you weren't the center of attention. We could have made you the center of attention, but you weren't. So they were busy on other things, but it was still pretty high. The important comparison is not that. It's how many of the people in the room actually did notice that it was Barry Manilow on your shirt. And there, it looked, as far as we could tell, nobody was able to tell that it was Barry Manilow on your
shirt. Do you mean to say that people aren't paying attention to everything that I do?
It is possible, yes.
Wow. So what do you call this effect then?
So this is a consistent problem with egocentrism. So one thing that makes it hard to understand what others are thinking is that we tend to rely on our own mind, perhaps a little bit too much, in contexts where it's not necessarily perfectly appropriate to do so. It may be a rational thing to do, but it still leads to inaccuracy. So in this situation here, you're wearing this Barry Manilow shirt, and Stephen, you're proud of this fact. You're strutting your stuff walking into this room. And because you're so aware of yourself, it's easy then to assume that others are more aware of you than they actually are. And that's just one of many different examples of where egocentrism or inherent focus on ourselves. You are always present when you are present. You are always aware of yourself and your own thoughts and feelings when you're out in the world. That can sometimes lead to errors. This is one case where it leads you to think that you're noticed more often than you actually are. We'll be right back.
What Epley is describing is sometimes called the spotlight effect. That's when you feel the spotlight is always shining on you, that for whatever reason people are paying attention to what you are doing. The spotlight effect. It was Tom Gilovich, by the way, Epley's thesis advisor, who coined that phrase. The spotlight effect is the kind of thing that Epley says can really distort how we communicate with each other. So coming up next week on Freakonomics Radio, Barry Manilow couldn't do it, but is it possible that Freddie Mercury can help you get the spotlight off yourself? I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. If you want more of our show, subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast app. You can get the entire archive on the Stitcher app or at freakonomics.com, where you can also sign up for our scintillating newsletter. Thanks for listening.